everybody. Welcome to lecture number 6 of the Human Action Part 1 course. Again, today we're dealing with a very short chapter, but it has, just like the previous chapter, has a lot of significant material in it. Now, before I get to the chapter, though, I want to spend some time talking about a few other things. In what I wanted to talk about comes about in this way. I was going over your answers to quiz number 4, and you remember I try to make these quizzes very easy. I'm not trying to trick people, but I saw there were a few points that some people had missed, and it convinced me I hadn't explained some of the points adequately enough. I'd done a bad job explaining these. I realized I had not spent enough time on these points because they're a bit difficult. This is why some people miss them. Most people did get them right. I could see why people would miss some of these answers because the correct answer is not what you would think if you just read, just kind of reason things just from what they appeared on the surface. It's the correct answer is a bit counterintuitive, as we like to say in philosophy. So I wanted to go over some of these points before we get to time. We always have time for time, but I do want to go over some of these points. Wait, it didn't. Let's see, did this? This didn't work. Okay, there we go. Now, one of the questions that I asked was, what did Marx think about the truth of his own system of thought? Now, remember, Mises discusses what he calls polylogism. This is the view that there's not just one logic, but different logics. And related to polylogism is the view that truth is relative to something. In Marx's case, the truth is relative to a particular class. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, what do we mean when we say something is true? Let's say it's true that I'm giving a lecture now. So that's stating a relation between the statement I'm giving a lecture now and reality. So it's a two-place relation. It's saying if reality agrees with the statement, then the statement is true. Now, the relativist view says that's the wrong analysis. It's truth is not a two-place relation between statement and the facts in the world that make the statement true, if in fact the statement is true. But according to relativists, the truth is a three-place relation, not just two. Three-place. It isn't enough to determine whether something is true to say, here's the statement, here's reality. You also have to know something else, say the class, if you think truth is relative to class. So that's what we mean by saying that truth is relative. Truth is a three-place relation. Knowing the statement and what reality isn't enough to determine truth. You need this third term also, the class. So Marx thought that everybody's thought is determined by the person's social class. So you'd have proletarian logic and bourgeois logic, and some things would be true for the proletariat, and they wouldn't be true for the bourgeoisie. So truth is relative to the social class. Now, here's the tricky part, and this is, some people missed this, and I should have gone over this more carefully. Now, you'd expect, supposing somebody holds that view, say Marx thinks that truth is relative to social class. So the question is, what would he think about his own views? You would expect him to say, well, since he thinks truth is relative, he would think that his own thought is true relative to the proletariat, since he's representing the proletariat. He's not a proletarian himself, but he thinks that some people can pass over into a different class. They can he's somebody who's gone over to the proletariat. So I think he would say that truth is relative, his own system of truth is relative to the proletariat. But in fact, he didn't say that. He probably should have to be consistent, but he didn't. He thought his own system was true. And the way he explained that, he said, well, you have these truths that are relative to various social classes, but history's moving in a certain direction. And the really true view is the one that is relative to the rising social class, which he thought was the proletariat. So even though he thinks that truth is relative to social class, he thinks that his own system is absolutely true. He doesn't think his system is just true for the proletariat. Now, I want to shift now to another point that is also a bit difficult, that I should have done a better job of explaining, that some people miss this. Now, remember when Mises, who's not to be confused with Marx, even though their names both begin with M and they were both very famous economists. Well, I guess there's a question. Steve said, what is the difference between his thought and his system? Well, I didn't intend any difference there, just ways of referring to the same thing, really. I didn't intend any difference there. It's just a case of variation, either elegant or inelegant variation, whichever you prefer. Okay, so Mises says, well, how does the historian work? You remember he talks about specific understanding. In praxeology, we get the general specifications of any action. What is the form of any action? Like every action has to use means to attain an end. You can't have an action that doesn't do that. But we have, praxeology doesn't tell you about specific actions, like what am I doing now? You won't get a praxeological deduction of that. To understand what I'm doing now, you have to use specific understanding. And how do you do that? Well, if you're a historian, say you're trying to explain what somebody's done, say Mises uses the example of Abraham Lincoln's policy in March 1861 at the beginning of the Civil War, you have to try to reconstruct what beliefs he had and what his desires were, what his value judgments were, what is it he wanted to do and what did he think he could do. And if you do that, you'll be able to explain what Lincoln did, and you'll be able to get the relevant factors and then make a judgment about which was the most important of those. Now here's the tricky part that some people missed. When the historian's doing this, the historian is trying to figure out the value judgments people hold. Okay, so, but when he's doing that, that isn't engaging in a value judgment yourself. Suppose I say, this was quite true, my late friend, Father James Sadowski, liked chocolate ice cream better than vanilla ice cream. In fact, he liked chocolate ice cream better than nearly anything else. So when I say that, I'm reporting a value judgment that he had. He liked chocolate ice cream. That's a value judgment. But I'm not that isn't a value judgment myself. It's a descriptive claim. It's a factual judgment. I'm not expressing any value judgment myself when I say that he liked chocolate ice cream. So more generally, historians saying or attributing value judgments to people is not himself, by doing that, engaging in any value judgments. So Mises thinks the historian's own value judgment, people have value judgments, are not part of specific understanding. And in fact, he thinks that if you have fair-minded historians, historians are trying to come up with the truth, but they have different value judgments. Let's say you had a historians are trying to explain how the Industrial Revolution came about, and you have one who's very favorable to capitalism and one who isn't, but they're both trying to explain what really happened. Mises thinks they should come up with the same explanations, whether they would or not is a different matter, but he thinks if they're fair-minded, their own value judgment shouldn't really enter into things. So this is I shouldn't have been surprised by this. I see there's a question here from Tom. Isn't what the historian considers important a result of their worldview? Well, it may be that what a historian considers important in the sense of what he values is results from his worldview. That would be an interesting question. But remember, what the historian is trying to explain is not what he himself thinks is important, but what the historical actors that he's dealing with thought was important. And he's trying to explain what they did, not what he holds. So his worldview should not, if he's doing his job properly, should not affect his historical explanation, or so Mises contends. And so people sometimes find that difficult to accept. I mean, this point about the difference between a value judgment and a statement about a value judgment, which is not a value judgment, say about someone's value judgment, is not itself a value judgment. You can get kind of a bit confused there. Suppose I say I prefer chocolate ice cream to vanilla, I'd be both expressing a value judgment, but I'd also, in the same way, saying sentence, be describing a value judgment that I have. So I'd be making both a value judgment and a descriptive statement at the same time. So it can be a bit tricky. Now, I remember just one kind of funny story, at least I think it was funny. One time at one of the Austrian scholars conferences, my great friend Roberta Madunio had given a paper, and I was helping her in the discussion because she's Italian. Her English is very good, and she thought she needed a bit of help. And someone raised the point, isn't ethical relativism the view, say, that value judgments are relative to something like a society or social class? Isn't that a self-contradictory view, because the person who holds value relativism doesn't think his own view is relative. He thinks his own view is true. Doesn't he contradicting himself because he says value judgments are relative, but he doesn't think his own view about value judgments are relative? So I said, no, that isn't a contradictory view, because the person is not who says that value judgments are relative is not making a value judgment. He's just making some claim about value judgment. So people started laughing. They thought I was making a joke. Now, normally I like it if people laugh, but I want them to laugh at my jokes. This was a serious statement. They thought it was a joke. So I didn't know whether they'd be happy they were laughing or upset that they thought that the serious statement was a joke. But you know, you do have to be careful about this point. Remember, the point to remember is the statement about a value judgment is not itself a value judgment. I see. Steve said, isn't it impossible to suspend one value judgment? It is impossible for some individual to be truly objective. Well, I don't know that that is the case. I mean, it might be difficult, but I don't know that that's right. I mean, somebody could say, suppose I'm saying, trying to explain what Marx was doing. I could say, I don't agree with his value judgments, but this is what he was aiming to do. I don't see why that couldn't be an objective statement. Remember, I said it's impossible. You remember that great comment Samuel Butler had on the statement in the gospel, you cannot serve both God and mammon. Samuel Butler said, difficult, no doubt, but nothing worth doing in life is easy. Prolonged laughter, I hope. Okay, so I want to get in another thing. Again, I'm not going to go on too much more about on these problems with quiz four, but I do want to cover some of these points because I think they're important and some people miss them. Mises has this skeptical attitude about metaphysics. Remember, metaphysics, there are some philosophers who have systems where they say, what is the ultimate structure of the world? Say, according to Hegel, the world really is the progress of absolute mind. And this isn't what you think about the world just commonsensically, but he thought he had very elaborate arguments to prove this. So there are all sorts of philosophers who have these very complicated arguments and systems trying to explain what the nature of the world is. And Mises tends to be very skeptical about those systems. He doesn't think people can do that. If you ask, why are you so skeptical? Well, one reason I'd like to suggest is that very often people who hold such systems also hold absolute systems of ethics. They'll say, here is what you're required to do regardless of whether you want to do this or not. And Mises is afraid that these systems can be used against the free market. Because the free market is saying, according to his view of the free market, you can say, well, if people want peace and prosperity, then they should establish a free market. And in fact, almost everybody does want peace and prosperity. So this gives us a good reason to support a free market. But what if you say, okay, well, maybe that's right, but there's some system of ethics that even if that's right, you still have to subordinate the free market to something else. But see, Mises is always concerned with possible attacks on the free market. So I think this is one reason he doesn't like these absolute systems of ethics, and he tends to associate metaphysics with such systems, and he just didn't care for metaphysics much. Now that isn't, you're not required to hold that view to accept Christology, but that was Mises' view, and so that was why I asked that question. So now that we've covered that, we can at last get to our chapter 5 on time. I did want to leave quite a bit of time to go into time. Mises begins by pointing out that all action involves change. In what way? Well, the person who's acting thinks that if he didn't act, the situation would be worse than if it should be than if he did, not if he didn't. I got mixed up there. So the actor is saying, well, what would happen if I acted? Would things be better than if I didn't act? Disregard this sentence here because I got the thing wrong. So more simply, when you're acting, you're expecting to improve things. Boy, I made two typos in this thing. Must have been even more off my rocker than usual there. Okay, so You're expecting to improve things, so that's why you're acting. So you can't, though, improve things unless things can be different. So supposing you think things could be improved, say you think you could improve things by turning off the lecture and switching to a different program. So you couldn't do that unless you could change things. So unless things could be different, you couldn't act. So action involves change. And when we have change, change occurs in time. So Mises concludes that action involves time. You couldn't have action if there wasn't time, because for action to take place, you need change, and change takes place in time. So Mises then draws a contrast between action, remember saying action involves time and change. In your acting, you think you can improve things, so things have to be able to change, and change involves time. And he contrasts this with a deductive system such as mathematics. Let's say in geometry, you start off with certain axioms and postulates, definitions, and then you deduce all the propositions of a system. So in a deductive system, all the parts of a system are present at once. It isn't that the axioms precede the theorems in time. Everything is there simultaneously. The whole system is there together. The deductive system really isn't in time. It's just a system of logical relations. Now, it's quite true. I suppose you're trying to understand the system. Suppose you remember from your high school geometry, you start off, you learn these postulates and axioms, and then you see how you can prove different theorems from them. So you'll start with the premises and work forward. But the system itself is timeless. You have to distinguish between the particular person who's going through the system, trying to understand the system, and the system itself. So the system itself is just timeless relations. The system isn't progressing in time, even though people who are working with the system are understanding it in time. Now, again, this is Mises is here reviewing a point he's made in previous chapters that we talked about. In order to act, you have to be able to grasp cause and effect relations. Again, let's take this example I gave. Suppose you want to switch this program off, you want to watch something else, you have to realize how you could do that on your computer. You know, pushing certain buttons would shut me off, and pushing certain other buttons would give you a different show. So you have to be able to grasp what are the cause and effect relations that would enable you to get what you want. Now, here's point's a bit tricky, and this point is analogous to the point I made earlier when I was talking about value judgments. Remember when I said you have to distinguish between value judgments and statements about value judgments, which are not themselves value judgments. Now, you have a similar distinction here in praxeology, which is the science of action. Remember, praxeology is a science that gives you the general form of all action. It will have a lot of things about cause and effect, just like, for example, the one I made is in order to act, you have to be able to grasp cause and effect relations. Well, that's a statement within praxeology. It's about cause and effect relations. So there are all sorts of others. But here's the tricky part. Even though praxeology contains the statement about cause and effect relations, the propositions of praxeology aren't themselves related by cause and effect. the proposition and praxeology are related by logical relations just as in other deductive systems. So it isn't, say, that the concept of action is causing the other statement, say, the concept of action doesn't cause the statement that any action involves use of means to attain an end. This is just derived by analyzing the concept of action. It isn't that the starting point is causing by cause and effect relations, the rest of praxeology. So this distinction I made, remember the distinction between things that take place in time and the relation of the deductive system, which are timeless. Praxeology is on the timeless side of that. The judgments of praxeology are themselves part of a deductive system. So even though they're about events that take place in time, they themselves are, this proposition praxeology are themselves expressed in timeless relations because they're part of a deductive system. Now, this point that Mises emphasizes that in order to act, we have to know cause and effect relations, we have to be able to grasp cause and effect relations, and any action involves change, has some very significant consequences for the way we conduct economics, or it's more general science of praxeology. One key point to remember that Mises emphasizes is that the direction of change is from past to future. We can't go back into the past and change that. There are all sorts of fantasies of going back into the past and changing, doing things, say, preventing somebody from being born. But those are just science fiction. We can't, in fact, change the past. And if something has happened, that's it. There are some philosophical problems here. I won't go into the distinction between changing the past and bringing about that the past never happened, but maybe we can address that in the discussion, but that's a bit complicated. But the basic thing we have to remember is if something has happened, then that's it. You can only make changes about it you can only affect what is going to happen, not what has happened. So why is this important in considering the way we conduct economics? Well, in mathematical economics, which is the way most economists do economics today, they'll use equations that express functional relations. What do we mean by this? Well, they say that one change goes together with another change. So you say income is a function of consumer spending. That means when consumer spending goes up, income goes up. But what's the difference between that and a causal statement? Well, the functional relation you find in the equation doesn't say that increase in spending causes an increase in income. It just says that there's a correlation. If one goes up, the other would go up. But it doesn't say, might be that it's the increase in income will cause an increase in consumption. A functional relationship isn't identifying a direction of causation. It isn't saying one thing is bringing about something else. It's just saying there's a relation between the terms in the equation. So you could think of it, it's not specifying which way the relation is going, just saying there's a relation. So in Mises' view, in economics, you're trying to explain cause and effect relationships. So functional equations are limited use for economics because they're not specifying any direction of causation. So this is one reason, not the only reason, but it is one reason you don't find Austrian economists using math very much, if at all, in their work, because in Austrian economics, we're, as Joe Salerno and Peter Klein like to use the phrase, it's a causal realist view. It's trying to figure out what are the causal relations things. To do that, you have to be able to identify the direction of causation, say, this is bringing about that. So this thing comes first, bringing about something else. So you can't do that just with a functional relationship that you find in an equation. Now, Mises makes a very interesting claim about our notion of time. How do we get the notion of time? And he says, well, we really get the notion of time from our acts. And what does he mean by that? He says, well, in having the notion of time, we have the concept of the present. So what do we mean by the present? This is the period in which we're able to act. So what the present is, I don't mean a gift here, but just the present in the way we're talking about time, it varies according to what the type of action is. So the present isn't objectively definable. We can't say, well, just look at the clock and that'll tell us what the present time is, because it's only, according to Mises, only our action, or only our doing something, will specify a period of time as the present. He said if we weren't acting, if we're just kind of sitting there thinking, the future would always pass immediately into the past. There wouldn't be a present, a real present. And Mises had read the French philosopher Henri Bergson quite a lot, and his works he wrote on time, concept of time, he was very popular, especially in the early part of the 20th century. Mises quotes him as speaking, is a phrase in French, about pure duration, which the flow of time is continuous, and where one passes by imperceptible steps from one state to another. The continuity is genuinely lived. So what Bergson is saying, Mises agrees with this, if you're just contemplating things, if you're not doing anything, then there is no present. You're just seeing, you get kind of a continuous flow, but you won't have a notion of a present time in which is between the past and the future. You'll just get the future immediately going into the past. And I must tell you one thing about this passage. You remember in Human Action, this is in French, so I translated this, and then I saw afterwards, I could have just gone to this Mises Made Easier glossary by Percy Graves. That already included a translation, so I didn't have to do all the work, but I hadn't thought of that. But so it shows I could have saved some time there, but so much the worse for me. So Mises then says, well, we've got the present, and again he's trying to define action, trying to define time as brought into being, or we get the concept of time through our action. So the present is the period in which we can act. So the past is the period in which action is not possible. Say, I can't do anything about the events of this Tuesday, so that makes Tuesday part of the past. And then the future is what can't be done because the conditions for undertaking it have not yet arrived. So the present is the period in which I can do something, the past is the period where I can't do anything anymore, and the future is when I will be able to do something, but the conditions haven't come up yet. Now, we could raise a problem, I just throw this out for discussion, when Mises says, conditions for undertaking have not yet arrived, one wonder, is that possibly circular? I think he might be able to get around that, but I'm not sure about that. But in any event, he says that the key point to remember is that Mises thinks that past, present, and future, when we have this in our concept of time, this is derived from our acting. So we only have the notion of present relative to particular actions that we engage in. One point makes, kind of interesting point I think that Mises makes about time is that time is always a scarce resource. We don't have unlimited time available. And why is that? Well, first of all, people live for only a certain number of years. Now you'll find, you younger people will find as you get older, this fact impresses itself on you more and more. I don't have as much time left as probably most of you do. I mean, you know, I'm old. I hope I have at least a couple weeks left, but, you know, at my age, you never know. So people live for only a certain number of years. And then there's a more basic fact that we've already mention is the flow of time can't be reversed. So if, say, let's say somebody lives a certain span of years, he'll only have available to him or her whatever years are left. He can't go back and use whatever time has already taken place. Again, flow of time can't be reversed. So I see a comment from Elliot that we hope we have at least enough time to complete this course. Well, I do too, because probably, I don't know if I keeled over, I don't know whether you could get your money back or partial refund, so I'd better keep going. But I appreciate your vote of confidence there for me. Maybe you could give me at least a little more time. You know the great story where a man went to the doctor. The doctor said to him, "I'm afraid I have some very bad news for you. You have 3 months to live. And I hate to tell you this, when I'm giving you such bad news, but you owe me $5,000. And the man said, "Oh, well, the doctor, I don't think I can raise $5,000 in 3 months." And the doctor says, "Okay, you have 6 months to live." Well, I laughed at that anyway. Okay, so we have that scarcity of time is always present. People live for only a certain number of years, and then once something has happened, you can't go back and do anything about it. So this state of affairs that time is always scarce would be true even if everything else were available in unlimited abundance. Let's say we didn't have to work, anything we wanted would be there for us. We'd still have to decide which of our wants to satisfy first. So time is always scarce. This is a basic fact that Mises places a good deal of stress on. Well, I see somebody has a joke here. This is a good one. I said, "The woman hears from her doctor that she has only half a year to live. Doctor advised her to marry an economist and live in South Dakota. Woman asks, 'Will this cure my illness?' Answer, doctor, 'No, but a half year will seem pretty long.'" That's a good one. I think I'll steal that one. Thank you. I can use that. Now, so far, it isn't very surprising to learn that time is a scarce resource. Maybe we don't want to think about that, especially those of us who are older, but it isn't anything people will question. I mean, you wouldn't think time is unlimited. But Mises makes a very surprising claim that this one is, at least I found it very hard to figure out at first, but I think I do have some explanation of what he had in mind. He says two actions of an individual are never synchronous. And what does he mean by that? You can't do two things at the same time. Well, this seems wrong. I mean, there's an old insult, you know, where you say about somebody, this person can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Well, it seems like, why can't you do more than one thing at the same time? So you think, well, isn't Mises pretty obviously wrong when he says that? So you have to, I think, if you think Mises made an obvious mistake, you have to go over and say, well, what could he have meant by that? And I think to understand what he means when he said two actions of an individual never synchronous, we have to remember that the present is defined relative to an action. Remember, I just went over this point. Remember that Mises said that present isn't something that just exists out there. The present comes into being relative to a particular action. If we weren't acting, then there wouldn't be a present. The past would flow immediately. The future would flow immediately into the past. There wouldn't be a gap between past and future. So the present is defined relative to an action. So if that's right, so we have the present exists only in relation to a particular action, then we see that Mises' statement that two actions of the same person can't take place at the same time isn't something that's obviously false. You think, well, why can't, say, I'm lecturing now, why can't I be doing something else at the same time? Why can't I be chewing gum while I'm lecturing? But we have to realize Mises isn't talking about what's happening in clock time. What he means is that each action defines a separate present. So it's a tautology, a statement that just true because of the meaning of the terms, that an action determines a particular present. There can't be two actions taking place in the same present because each action determines a separate present. So it's just true from the way Mises has characterized present that there can't be simultaneous actions or synchronous actions, as he called them. So you have to be very careful sometimes when you're reading Mises that sometimes a statement he intended a tautology, remember tautology again, is a statement that's true just because of the meaning of the terms. You have to be careful. He'll make statements that sound like they're empirical claims that might be false, but they're really tautologies. Remember, we dealt with one of the past lecture. Remember, Mises says action aims to relieve felt uneasiness. So remember we mentioned last time Ayn Rand objected to that. She said, well, can't you just act because you want something, you're feeling joyful? Doesn't Mises have this very negative psychology? He's thinking people are just all uneasy about things, so they're acting because they're feeling bad. But Mises doesn't mean that when he's just defining felt uneasiness as not preferring the present situation to the future situation. So he's just making his statement as a tautology. So in a similar way here, when he says two actions can't take place at the same time, you think, well, how could that be? Why couldn't two actions take place at the same time? He's again making it staying a tautology because he's characterized a present as existing just in relation to a particular action. Now, we now want to deal with another topic. Remember, I mentioned before where Mises criticized the mathematical equations that are used in contemporary economics. Remember, Mises says, well, these equations just express functional relations. They say one change is correlated with a different change. They don't identify any direction of causation. So now I want to deal with another topic, very interesting one, is on page 103, where Mises again has a very different view of a certain question from the way that's customary to view this topic in the classical economics. And the topic in question is so-called transitive preferences. Let's imagine, suppose you prefer A to B, you also prefer B to C. What happens when you have a choice between A and C? Well, let's say you prefer chocolate ice cream to vanilla ice cream, you prefer vanilla to strawberry. But what if you have a choice between chocolate and strawberry? Well, if you prefer the chocolate to the strawberry, then you have a transitive set of preferences. So you say if A, you prefer A to B, B to C, then you prefer A to C, that your preferences are transitive. But suppose you preferred C to A, then you would have intransitive preferences. So again, you prefer chocolate to vanilla, and you prefer vanilla to strawberry, but you prefer strawberry to chocolate. That would be intransitive preferences. So according to neoclassical economists, they think that if you have intransitive preferences, your preferences are irrational. They say something like, you're somehow inconsistent if you have that set of preferences. There are various arguments they would give for that conclusion. Like one is, under certain conditions, you can show that if somebody has intransitive preferences, he'll lose all his money, because you would just give the person, you would keep making trades with the person, taking advantage of his intransitive preference, and you could show, I won't go through the argument, you could show under certain conditions the person would lose all his money. But, so the neoclassicals, though, regardless of that argument, they say, if you have intransitive preferences, you're irrational. Remember, Mises isn't going to go along with that, because he thinks that there's no such thing as irrational action. Every action is aiming to achieve something, and the person is rational in the sense that means he's using are ones that he thinks are going to enable him to get what he wants. He could be wrong about it, but that's what he thinks. So Mises is going to look askance at any claims that there can be irrationality in some action. So what does he have against this view about transitive preferences? So what he says is that, remember, preferences exist only in action. Remember, we talked about this the last time, I think, or one of the previous lectures, I think it was the last one, that it isn't that we have, imagine, a preference scale existing in somebody's mind, and then we say, well, the person is acting in a certain way, either in agreement with the preference scale or in not agreeing with it. The preference exists only in action. So if transitive preferences are in fact irrational, that would exist only if someone at the same time preferred A to B, B to C, and C to A. So this couldn't be shown in action, because all you'd be doing in action, say, is choosing one particular thing over another. Say, imagine, let's say, a person had a choice between chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. So he would pick one of them, but you wouldn't be able to tell just from his action what his preferences were on these two-step, imagine just the two ice creams being shown to him, what he would choose in each one. You're just in Austrian economics, we're just concerned with the actual choice, the demonstrated preference. So we can't come up with these statements about what the person would have chosen if in these other circumstances. So we're not able to say that at a particular time people have these preferences A to B, B to C, and C to A. Now I see Maury says I may just want to try something different at the food counter instead of taking the same old thing. Sometimes vegetables are preferred to cakes and cookies. Well, that's a very good point. It actually gets into what I'm going to talk about in the next slide, assuming I live long enough to push the correct button, which I did. Somebody could change his preferences over time. Supposing, say, at one time you prefer A to B, another time you prefer B to C, and then you prefer C to A. But there's nothing irrational about that. The supposed irrationality was that you have all these preferences at the same time. Oh, I see there's a question about my slide. Let me just go over this. You ask, let's go back to the slide. Second bullet, the irrationality. Yes, that's right, of intransitive preference. You're quite right. Another one of my many mistakes. Thank you. Okay, so, and I say the supposed irrationality of intransitive preferences would occur only if you have all these preferences at the same time. But if you just change your mind, supposing, let's imagine this, whenever you're presented with chocolate and vanilla, you take chocolate. Then at a later time, you're presented with vanilla and strawberry, and you pick vanilla. Then at a still later time, you have chocolate and strawberry, and you prefer strawberry. There's nothing irrational about that. You just have different preferences at different times. So the irrationality, the inconsistency is supposed to be, well, how could it be if you prefer A to B and B to C that you also prefer C to A? But if you talk about preferences at different times, you can change your preferences. So if you now prefer C to A, irrationality that doesn't require that you still prefer A to B and B to C. So it's just you've changed your preference. We can't say that you still have these other preferences and you now have added an inconsistent preferences to the preference, these other preferences, so you have an inconsistent set. All we know is you have a new preference. And there's nothing wrong with changing your preference in response to a new situation. That, in fact, can be a sign of irrationality. If you say, well, I just have the same preference as I always did, that isn't required for rationality. It could just mean you're set in your ways in a way that perhaps isn't ideal. So Mises thinks that if we're talking about action, we can't just talk about preference scales apart from action. If we're talking about action, then we can't really use this notion of intransitive preference, because what we would be faced with is just, all we could say is there's been a change in preference, and we can't say that stability of preferences is a requirement of rationality. Well, okay, I think that's the last thing I wanted to say, and this puts Mises at odds with at least most neoclassical economists, because they do want to make transitivity a requirement of preference. And when someone says, after class I'm heading out for some ice cream, well, it sounds like a good idea. I'll probably, if you get ice cream, it'll clean the taste of this lecture out of your mouth. Good idea. Okay, so now we'll go to the question period, so you can put your question either in the chat or the Q&A box, whichever you prefer. We have a little, I finish a few minutes early, so we have a little time, extra time. Okay, don't all hurry to be the first one to ask a question. It seems as though constancy is not a category of practice. Oh, yes, that's right. So you don't have, you're not required to just stand fast in whatever preferences you have. That certainly isn't a category of praxeology or of rationality. Now, Marcus says, not a question, but the past is already determined. The present extends through a series of cause and effect relations from the beginning of the act to satisfactory completion. The future is yet to be determined. Yes, well, that would certainly be one view of the matter, probably. I mean, many people would hold that. I don't know that you'd be required to hold that view, but that certainly is one of the, it's a plausible view, but I don't know that it's one that's required, but I mean, you could certainly hold that view. Possible problem for it is if there's a series of cause and effect relations, would that determine what's going to happen in the future? Or would the future be yet to be determined if there's a series of cause and effect relations that bring about the future? Could I just throw that out for your consideration? Okay, we have one here from David Scott. The issue of time is one of the distinct areas of difference between Austrian and mainstream economics. Is this correct? Could you expand on some of the resulting differences in economic analysis? Well, we'll be getting into this in one of the later lectures. One difference is that in Austrian economics, we use the notion of pure time preference, which is that people prefer satisfaction in the present to the future, and in the near future to the far future. And this is regarded by Mises as a category of action. And in mainstream economics, this is more taken as an empirical fact that they think, many mainstream economists think the notion of negative time preference is possible. And this wouldn't, Irving Fisher was a famous monetary economist, talks about negative time preference, but to Austrians that wouldn't be possible. So that's one difference. But we'll be talking about time in the later ones. Well, Maury says, thanks for the great class. I got to go. Well, all right, so I guess now we can, as soon as he leaves, we can start talking about Maury. Just a joke. Now, okay, Andrew says, to revisit transitivity, would it be correct to say that neoclassical economics rejects the idea of a subjectivity evaluation is always rational? I think that's possibly right to the extent they impose certain requirements on preference to be rational, such as transitivity. So I think that you're right on that. Now, Tom says, if we can have negative interest rates, I guess there can be negative time preference. Well, I think there's a possible problem there in that, remember, the interest rate isn't determined just by the time preference rate. You have other things going into the interest rate, like the risk factors and other, especially. So it could be that even if you have negative interest rate, it isn't brought about by negative time preference, but kind of the positive time preference is swamped, as it were, by something else. Okay, now Rod says the concept of time is actually something eternal. Now feeling I get when I'm working on something, lose track of time. And I think that's a very good observation. Now, Tim says, can you have two present times occurring simultaneously, thereby being able to have two actions, same clock time? Well, I mean, the action would exist, the present for each action would just be exist for that action. I think you could have the two actions might be taking place in the same clock time, but they wouldn't be simultaneously two present. So in the way Mises talked about simultaneous actions, they wouldn't be simultaneous because what's taking place isn't simultaneously. It's not the present times. Those are just unique to the action, but just he's just saying that these two actions are talked about within a certain clock time, but that isn't what we're doing, we're concerned with in praxeology. So David said he wishes me, it's a Scottish phrase, wishing me a long life. Well, I hope you get what you ask for. And Tom said, does anyone know what time it is? Well, you remember St. Augustine said, whenever I know what time is, but whenever I want to talk about it, then I can't say what it is. But I know what it is just when I can't express it. I think that's kind of an interesting quotation. Now, John says, prefaces in action time, that is there inseparable. Yes, that's Mises' view. That's exactly right. So Mises doesn't want to talk about what are your preferences apart from what you're actually doing. There's some philosophers say, well, look, you could do something, but that isn't what you most prefer to do. You're just kind of overcome by things right away. Suppose, say, somebody's an alcoholic. He could prefer not to drink, but he just, when he sees a drink, and he just drinks, even though it's not his preferred action. So the Austrian view, that wouldn't be a correct analysis. We would just say, well, when the person chooses drink, then drinking is his highest ranked goal because it's just shown in his action. And I'd like to thank David Scott for wishing me a long life. It's very kind of you. I'm sure a certain website owner would say I'd lived more than long enough. Now Elliot says, what's the next course I'm teaching? I don't really know that. Danny would be the one to ask about it, but he hasn't told me yet. Probably they're still thinking about it, probably. time to human action two. No, probably human action two would be taught by one of the economists. Now, Kant says, why does Mises say this is not a work of philosophy? Well, Mises, remember, he talks about a lot of philosophical terms, but he's not developing a philosophical system. When he's talking about philosophical topics, he's doing this just because they're important to explaining certain things in economics. He's trying to justify what he's doing and reply to critics of the way he's doing things, but he's not trying to come up with a system of philosophy just on its own. But he, of course, he does have a lot to say about, I think, very important, insightful remarks about all sorts of philosophical topics. But remember, he's an economist, and that's his primary focus. Tim said something I never could grasp from an earlier lecture. How exactly is a priori proposition, a priori concept, not knowledge? Well, an a priori proposition is knowledge. You see, so probably that's why you couldn't grasp how it isn't knowledge. But see, what do we mean by knowledge? Well, that's a difficult question. But when you say you know something, you have to have some kind of statement, like say, I know that I'm giving a lecture now. I'm making a statement, and we could say, do I know that? But let's say I just take the word lecture. That isn't knowledge because it's not making any claim. It's just an idea or concept. So an a priori concept isn't knowledge because it's not making any claim about anything. It's just saying, here is a concept that people have. So that isn't knowledge. You see, it's not a difficult point. It's just the way the term knowledge is used. For something to be knowledge, it has to be a claim or an assertion. A concept just by itself isn't a claim. Now, John says, you have to read these several times to understand what he means. Thank you for the enlightenment. Yes, I think that is right. He writes in it, like, consider a deceptively simple way. Sounds like you should be able to get what he's saying right away, but it's more difficult than one might think. David Hume, who influenced Mises a great deal, was very much like that also. He writes very well, but it's not always easy to get what he means right away. Now, Collins says, sometimes it sounds like Mises is saying all knowledge rests on a priori category, but it means criticism of positive humanities also apply to other sciences. Well, I think he would criticize the way the logical positivists explained other sciences also to the extent they denied that they were a priori categories. I think he would criticize. Not all the logical positivists did deny that. There was some Kantian influence on them as well. But I think he would criticize anyone who denied that knowledge rests on categories, not just people who denied this in economics. We have a question here. Could you briefly explain the specifics how a tariff works, in particular, who actually pays the tax, and how is it laid? Do businessmen who import goods directly pay to the government a specific amount? Well, that isn't too praxeological a question, but in general, a tariff is a duty imposed on a good that's imported. So whoever is bringing the good in has to pay the tariff. So let's say there's a tariff on Toyotas. So supposing you want to sell Toyotas, then you would have to pay the government whatever the tariff is in order to bring them in. So they do pay the government a specific amount. Yeah, I think that would be and I mean, there'd be some question also, can they pass the tax on to the consumer by raising the price? That would be a more difficult question to answer. I see that Tom DiLorenzo has talked about that, so I'm happy to defer to him on this question. Probably, if you were in his class, you'd be asking him all sorts of questions about praxeology. You know, someone, John, the tariff equals higher price for imports. Yes, that's the way my understanding is. Now, let's see. Here's one from David Kramer. Could we say the concept lecture is knowledge from the standpoint that it has a meaning which includes some action, excludes some other kinds of action? Well, it certainly has a definition. I mean, it's certain things are included under the concept lecture and other things aren't. But as philosophers use the term knowledge, that fact that it has a meaning wouldn't make it knowledge. Again, this isn't any profound point about knowledge. It's just the way the term is used. So the concept lecture isn't making an assertion. Suppose you said something like someone going swimming is not giving a lecture. That would be a statement that could be knowledge, but the concept, just the concept by itself, isn't knowledge as that term is generally used, because it's not making any assertion, even though every concept includes certain things, and, or probably every concept includes certain things and excludes others. Maybe there are some that don't, but they generally do. Here's one from Colin Knight. I'm reading Mises' Epistemological Foundation of Economics for the second time because of this course. I understand it a lot more because of your lecture course. Would you consider in the future bringing the two of them together? Well, that's an interesting idea. We'd have to, that would be up to Danny, really. I have given a course on Mises' epistemology where I consider these different books. I mean, that has been done, although I haven't devoted any course not. Now, John says, is not obtaining knowledge of the world either application a priori or a posteriori analysis? Yes, I think that's right. We're either reasoning things out without reference to experience, or we're getting the knowledge from experience. I think that's right. Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. It's epistemological problems of economics, and there's ultimate foundations of economics. One was one of Mises' earlier books, and the other was one of his last books. Maybe he meant that I should really be amalgamating those two books into one book and then taking that new book in connection with human action. Now, Rock is that it, Kramer says, is not a priori saying the self-evident a good common sense. An a priori notion is indeed a fact because we've learned it one way or another to be true. So this must necessarily be knowledge as John the Street would interpret. Is this how many angels can dance on the head of a pinch? Well, no, an a priori proposition is one that you can justify, you can know apart from experience. It wouldn't have to be self-evident. I mean, some a priori proposition might be very difficult to figure out. It would just be true apart from experience that you might have to be, might be very hard to grasp that, say, some kind of complicated mathematical theorem. And there are self-evident propositions that are not a priori. So you say, I didn't exist in the 18th century. That's pretty self-evident common sense, but it's not a priori. And I don't think it's useless if you mean by, I don't know, you mean how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Well, I mean, that was an interesting, actually, it's an interesting issue. Dorothy Sayers once wrote a pamphlet saying she doubted any of the scholastics had ever discussed that, but if they had, it would have been certainly an interesting question. So, does an immaterial being exclude any other immaterial beings from being in a particular location? I think that would be a very interesting question. It wouldn't be a useless one at all, actually. Tim said, Kane said, did you say that each act made his own present time? Yes. The action, according to Mises, really gives you the present. So each action really gives you the present for that action. The present isn't something that's there objectively in time, because in time, according to Mises, you just have the past and the future. So the present comes into existence only with a particular action. Now, Ray says, what is the relation between time and uncertainty? Well, that's something we'll be dealing with in the lecture next week, which is on uncertainty. I'm not uncertain I'm going to be talking about uncertainty. I'm certain that I will. But basically, if we're acting, the future has, according to me, has some degree of uncertainty in it. The certainty, according to Mises, would just be present there in the past, not in the future. But we'll be covering that in more detail next week, I think. Now, Colin says, early in the course, you were commenting on Mises' discussion about if an omnipotent being could act because this being would not have felt unease. Yes. That's right. Did you want me to go over what I said about that, or what I said was, see, Mises thought, well, an omnipotent being would never be dissatisfied, but so it would just have what it wanted right away, so it would never feel the need to act. But I raised a problem there is that the being could still act in the sense that it's never dissatisfied, but it would realize if it didn't act in a certain way, it would be dissatisfied. So it's still acting, even though it never actually is. Every state of affairs is the best possible for it, but it bringing this about, because if it didn't act, it would be dissatisfied. Now, David said certain Mises didn't like his brother. Yes, I think that they didn't get along. The younger brother didn't get along. Richard von Mises, who was a mathematician and also worked on aerodynamics and was a very well-known physicist and applied mathematician. But Mises did use his brother's theory of probability, though we'll be talking about that. Now, Collins says, wouldn't that still be dissatisfied from how it felt now about the future? No, because it's always sad. The being would always be satisfied with what actually takes place. It's that it would be counterfactually dissatisfied if it didn't act, but it never is dissatisfied. You see, just dissatisfaction in some possible world, not the same as the actual world. I know that sounds a bit difficult, but it really isn't, at least I don't think so. So the being is, the omnipotent being is never actually dissatisfied. Now, here's one from Andrew regarding polylogism. How is thought defined? When we say different class of different logic of thought, are we saying that two individuals literally interpret objective reality different? Example one, individual thinks a red apple is red while I think it's green. Well, Amin is talking about polylogism, just the system of logic that people use. He isn't really directly addressing perceptual relativism. I mean, some people said, well, there, and this is controversial, some people say different groups of people have different color concepts, but that's something Mises really doesn't go into. So he's just going to talk about polylogism, meaning that he's denying the view that people have a different logics. He's not saying that people always have the same perceptual categories. I don't know what he would have said about that. Now, Russ says, wouldn't it mean that if it felt dissatisfaction or the possibility to feel future satisfaction, that it would not, it was not omnipotent? No, it isn't feeling that dissatisfied or that maybe it will feel dissatisfied. It's just there's a possible world in the possibility. Let me put it this way, better way of putting it. In this view that I'm giving, the possibility that the being was dissatisfied if it didn't act doesn't go against omnipotence, because in fact the being always does act in a way that precludes dissatisfaction. So it would actually be, even though it's a possible world, this is getting into very difficult logical territory, it's a sort of an impossible possibility. It's a possibility that is incapable of realization. That's a very difficult topic. So it's a possibility that's never, it's necessarily non-actual, and then there could be some question, is it really possible? You see, you get into some rather complicated modal logic trying to go into that, so that's one reason I didn't try to go into it. But you're right, that's a very good question you raise. It's just gets us into some rather tough issues. Now, you say if it regresses back to the beginning, doesn't it lose omnipotence? I'm not seeing why that's so, because if every time it acts, it always acts in a way that it's not getting what it wants. I don't see that it would there'd be some beginning in which it wasn't omnipotent. That would contradict the concept, I suppose. Did you get a chance to see the letter I sent to you by email, PDF? Could you remind me what the letter was about. I have to check for that. While you're checking, Andrew says, I'm sorry, I'm still confused about me, my different logics. Is there another way of explaining it? Are we talking about how people think rather than what they think? Yeah, well, you know, in logic, you know, we have, you know, certain laws of thought like law of identity or law of non-contradiction. Nothing can be both A and not A at the same time. So a different logic would be one that didn't use the same laws of thought as the ones we did. That exactly is the way the normative conditions under which people think. So what, suppose we say, what is a correct argument? What is a valid argument? If you had different logics, you would have different answers to that. And Mises thinks, no, everybody uses the same logic. Everybody has the same sense of what is a valid argument. It isn't that, say, some people accept the law of identity and others don't. He thinks everybody, all people who reason use the same logic. But it isn't that all people think the same thing. It's just they use the same standards of validity in thinking. I hope that helps a little bit. We have a few more minutes, and anyone has any last minute comments, objections. Tomorrow I'm leaving. There's going to be a conference at the Mises Institute. It should be very nice. They're having Ron Paul and Judge Napolitano will be there. It's in Callaway Gardens. That's a very nice place. They had a conference there in 1998 that I went to.
And Mises Institute members can watch it live online for free.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, this is the 30th anniversary conference. It's a very important conference. Now, Colin says, well, UBC. Yes, I'm talking about Murray Rothbard and revisionism. Or not a very praxeological topic, but I'll be giving Rothbard's views on revisionist history. I'd better think of something to say fast. David says, I like your view of libertarian anarchy. Casey really doesn't go into details about how he's not a really political figure. He just presents the argument, and I guess he hopes people will accept it. And Jonathan, imaginary concepts to understand the real world. Well, Mises uses imaginary concepts, you know, such as the evenly rotating economy. This is sometimes very important. He talked about the method of imaginary construction, so this is very important in praxeology. You're very right to bring that up. Oh, yes. Jared Casey's Teaching Logic. I'm sure that's a very good course. I remember I was going over with him when I was teaching. We're going over different ways of teaching logic. He teaches traditional logic, the same as I did in my course. He can do mathematical logic also. Oh, Rod's taking course. I'm not surprised it's very good. First lecture is free. Well, that's even better. because he's very good. He has great jokes, too. Well, I guess we're out of time now, so thanks very much for coming to the lecture. Hope we'll see you all next week for lecture number 7. Thank you. Thanks a lot, everybody.